ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I'm your host with the most, Alex Corbisair. It's great to be back, everyone. Excuse my voice. I've been under the weather this weekend and been battling a sore throat, and it's slowly getting better, but you can probably hear it if you're a regular listener. But lots to talk about in this week's show. Obviously, going to really focus around the Rugby World Cup 2021 in New Zealand. Another big weekend of it this weekend on Peacock TV, with the USA-Canada game replaying on CNBC. And, you know, to talk about that, we got actually USA Rugby head coach Rob Kane on the show. And then after that, we'll have Chris Jones from BBC Rugby Union correspondent to talk through the Rugby World Cup 2021. And then we'll look at the Premiership and some of the big picture issues going on. Be great to get his insight there. But for now, let's get into the Rob Kane interview. Joined by USA Rugby head coach Rob Kane. Rob, welcome to the Scrum Down. Thanks for making time for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
And obviously, Rob, you know, before we get into the details of the tournament, you're a coach who's been involved in the women's game for some time now. You know, what have you made at this World Cup and sort of the evolution and the growth of the women's game that we're sort of getting to watch every week at the moment?
Yeah, an experience like nothing I've ever experienced before in terms of technical detail, tactical prowess, and just the ability for players to showcase their best. I think the scorelines are so much closer than what they've been historically, and the game's a lot more exciting, and it really is, it does come down to those small differences in terms of the results. So for the neutral, it's great. For the coaches, a few more grey hairs.
I can only imagine. Lots going on there. But let's get into the tournament a little bit, and you know, what have you made of the US's journey so far?
Yeah, up and down. I think, you know, there's always, for us, we've got different challenges. Every country has different challenges. Our challenge is time. Our challenge is time together. So I think the pleasing thing is that every time we add more to our game, we're seeing it replicated in real time. And I suppose the scary thing is, what would happen if we had even more time together? You know, where would we be? But we're pleased with where we are. Our goal was the quarterfinal. We're pleased with elements of our performances. We haven't had a complete performance yet, but we're excited at the opportunity to play against Canada again.
And I think the fact, you know, obviously that first game to Italy is probably one that must have frustrated you a lot. But when you actually look at the seedings and the way it worked out, you know, Canada's a team that you know well. You've played a lot recently. You've just shown on the weekend that you can be quite competitive with them. It actually could have worked out better for you in the big picture, as weird as that might be, saying, oh, I would have rather if it happened this way, coming through as the best third place team.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's an element of truth in that. Like, if you would have said at the start of the tournament that we'd have the opportunity to play against a team that we know we can beat, and I think we showed that at the weekend, that we can beat them, rather than playing against an England, New Zealand, which is a very different prospect, or we'd have taken that. So, and that's a big reason why we're excited for the knockouts.
And then let's look at the game against Canada. You know, I thought, you know, the first half didn't quite go your way, but I thought you made good adjustments in the second half to at least give yourself more control of the game, which showed that it could be a much more competitive match out there.
Yeah, look, I think coming into the role in the first place, you know, the main priority back in 2018 was to create a set piece that we could use as a platform and have the ability to be able to turn teams through a kicking game, things that haven't historically been prioritized. And then, of course, we want to play with width and play to the best space and opportunity. And so we're showcasing that more and more. Our discipline let us down, and you know, we spoke about that as a group, and we've got a review as a group later today as well. But if we can tidy up our discipline and ensure that our set piece launch is better in terms of the phases that we build, and we're able to take care of the threats that Canada do pose at breakdown time, and we keep turning them, we're going to have a good day.
I completely agree. I think your two tries came, you know, both on the 9-phase mark, which obviously shows that, you know, you're a handful when you hold on to the ball. I think those missed line-out opportunities just turn the possession and the territory against you as well. And if you're able to tidy those up, as well as the breakdown, which was, you know, that them as a whole were getting turnovers, but also I feel like potentially there's an opportunity for you as a team to be a bit more aggressive at the breakdown, just to try and stop them holding on to the ball for as long as they did in your half, because that's really where it only came unstuck, other than the driving more.
Yeah, definitely. I echo exactly what you said, Alex. Like, you know, our first clearer wasn't as impactful as what we were liking, and we need to get to our working height a lot sooner and be a lot more aggressive in that area to ensure that we can actually play at the speed that we want to play, because we want to play quick rugby, aggressive, fast and smart rugby. And when we can put it together, as we've shown, we're a handful on any team. So we've got a couple of training days to be able to refine a few areas, also show a few new things that we haven't shown before, which we've tried to do every week. So yeah, we're excited as a group.
Definitely. And then what's the overall mood? I guess you've touched on excitement, but how do you feel like the players are sort of coming together, you know, this week before probably the biggest game of most of their careers?
Really well. I mean, like, they really do believe that we can beat Canada. And I think, you know, we talk a lot as coaches, and we talk a lot as like leadership groups, as players, but from 1 to 32, everyone was, I'm not going to use the word, but disappointed. There's a different word that I'd use, but they're angry. And we've not had an angry team before, not in my reign here. So that's why I'm really excited, because there's even more purpose and drive to be able to put in the performance that will get us to a semi-final. And that's everyone's aspiration. Everyone woke up yesterday excited at the prospect of the game. And yeah, it's a good feeling.
And there's one thing I love about this group is just the commitment and the all-inness of it. You know, launching their own foundation to help fund them to getting here, having a number of players that were willing to move over to the UK to play Premier 15s to get the best competition they could, as well as other players moving around for WPL. You know, just talk a little bit about the buy-in of the squad you've had, and you've had them together for quite some time as you, with you in charge. Talk a bit about the journey.
Yeah. Lots of wonderful memories and lots of challenges, good days, bad days, smiles and tears. And I think, you know, people talk about sacrifices, and our group really has have to make those tough sacrifices. They've moved overseas. They've given up careers in terms of their work. They put their life on hold to really not just aspire to play for their country, but to do special things. And with this group in particular, we're quite lucky. When you look at some of the other nations, you know, you're going to get a lot of players that could retire, that could really step away. And for us, you know, we're very much driven to be able to get better every day. And when you think about the age that some of our players started playing, now they're just beginning to really get to grips of international rugby. And that's a scary thing, because the prospect of maybe 6 or 7 or 8 players with 50 caps, it's never been done before. Like, that's when you're really going to go and do the things that we aspire to do in terms of trying to top the world. But you have to go through those sacrifices to make this happen. It shouldn't be the way, but very fortunate to have a wonderful group of people that are prepared to do that, who trust in me, believe in me, and I back them every day of the week, and I give back to them tenfold.
So you've been in charge now about 4 years, obviously got an extra year with the World Cup cycle due to COVID, but do you feel like this could be a bit of a legacy-defining game for you? You know, taking a team to a semi-final would be a big accomplishment.
I think, yeah, of course it would be, without a shadow of a doubt. I think it would be a wonderful achievement, especially with the challenges that we faced. And, you know, we lost a year through COVID, and we didn't play test matches for some time. And, you know, creating a team and a program and really trying to build sustainable success, which is what the goal is. Yeah, most definitely. But I think for me, just the changes that we've made with the players already Like that's already a legacy. The way that we're trying to play the game and the development that we've had and the integration that we're trying to have through the pathways and giving the players opportunities to go overseas and for them to have individual success. I think we've already been successful. I think this would be a really nice moment to cap it off before we then enjoy the real success. And for us, real success will be being able to compete back to back against the top three teams in the world before eventually we can leapfrog them. And that's been the goal since 18. Obviously, with different funding challenges and different prospects, not having the players as much as what we'd like, it takes a little bit longer, but this group can do it and we can definitely make that happen.
No, well, all right, park this World Cup now, and that's such a great answer, by the way. But then, you know, looking ahead to another 4 years, you kind of just hinted to a little bit about the growth. What needs to change for USA Rugby to give you that opportunity to be able to compete with these top sides? Because professionalism has crept in across the world now. There's multiple teams, and that's why this tournament seems to be at an all-time high level. And that's really what touched me on your legacy, is to get to a semi-final against teams that are professional is an incredible achievement.
It would be, yeah, it really would be. I think, you know, there's lots of people that are working very hard in the background. I think domestically we have a lot of work to do to ensure that players don't have to make those hard choices and we can really develop the game in America. And it'd be wonderful to have, you know, other overseas players having the opportunity to play in a really strong domestic league. Every head coach or every coach is going to talk about having time with the players, but I think just having more of a support network for the players. I mean, for this World Cup, obviously we have a full-time staff that are here in person, but I am still only the full-time member of staff, you know, in terms of the program. So it's trying to get more support around me so we can actually give the players the support they need. And then on top of that, looking at contracts, whether that be part-time and realistically, just so they can be supported and get rest and not have to work two jobs. And we're really buying their time off and time to be able to have together that's not pressured. You know, preparing teams with 5 or 6 days before a test match is not ideal, especially against teams that have come out of massive camps. I mean, we did have 21 days in Atlanta, which was fantastic, but when you look at that compared to someone that's leading the way, let's say England at the moment, they're full-time already and they come out of a 10-week camp. You just can't compete. You know, we're trying very hard, but there's a limit to what we can do with the time that we're given.
And then lastly, you know, finish on a nice note. What's your favourite part of the job that you have right now? What brings you the most enjoyment out of it all?
Seeing players do things they couldn't do before and then actually seeing players having those penny drop moments where they don't just have belief, they actually start to lead. And, you know, we had a very young, inexperienced, quiet group that came about. And now we have some very strong, very intelligent, very influential leaders. And I'm really proud of their journey.
Great stuff, mate. We're wishing you all the luck on the weekend. Live on Peacock, repeating on CNBC. Rob, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Alex.
Ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Great to hear from Rob Kane on the show. Big game coming up for the USA. Can they pull it off against Canada? Reminder, that is live on Peacock TV at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday. It will be replaying on CNBC with Abby Gustaitis and Lee Diffie in studio. Don't miss that. But now it's time to hear from BBC Rugby Union correspondent Chris Jones to talk the Rugby World Cup 2021. And welcoming Chris Jones, BBC rugby correspondent, back to the pod. His first time on the Scrum Down since the relaunch and since we've gone video. Chris, welcome back to the show, mate.
Mate, good to be here. I every time I listen to Scrum Down, I wonder where the rap at the front has gone. That used to really get me in the mood, you know. Welcome to the Scrum Down. Where's it gone?
Down, prepare to bow down to the best in town. I know, it was a... The diehards remember it and do ask about that. You're not the first one to ask that. But with the revamp, we tried to make it a bit more professional. That rap was so old as well. If anything, I need to do a better and newer one at some point when I have a bit more
voice. I don't know how you could beat that. That was the
you haven't
best
heard
rap
me flow
at the start
recently,
of a rugby
mate.
Podcast.
You haven't heard me flow recently. I'm telling you, once I have my voice back, I'm sharper than I've ever been. Trust me.
Okay, once you come over here for the Autumn Internationals, then we'll catch up and I'll see how your rapping's going.
I'm telling you, mate, it's out of control. It's out of control. But anyway, the reason we brought you on, well, two things to talk about. We've got Premiership Rugby. We'll get to that in the second segment. But first segment, we're talking about Rugby World Cup 2021 in New Zealand. What have you made of the competition so far?
I've enjoyed it, but I think it's about to get a lot better. Where we are, a lot of games have taken place in the dead of the night, so we probably haven't had that kind of real excitement around the matches, apart from the one game, which was the England-France game, which kicked off about 8 a.m., 8:30 a.m. UK time. So I had that game on, listening to my colleagues on the radio as well. I had my little daughter on my lap. She was transfixed with it. And that was a, you know, really tough, hard-fought game of World Cup rugby. The other England games, from an England point of view, have been kind of processions. The Scotland-Wales game really went to the wire, and that kept people pretty gripped. But otherwise, it's been a little bit disappointing from a Scotland point of view. And Wales kind of go into the Lions' den, don't they, against New Zealand in one of the Saturday quarterfinals this weekend. But I think the tournament is about to really pick up. A combination of the kickoff times has made it sort of not the easiest to follow for a lot of fans back here, but I think once we get into quarterfinal, semi-final time, and if the England Red Roses are going towards the final, then I think people really sit up and go, wow, what an opportunity for them to recreate what the England Lionesses did in the Euros football in the summer.
Absolutely, like such an opportunity for this England side. It's a shame with the time difference, because here in America it's worked out quite well, especially on the West Coast. We're getting like anywhere from a 4:45 p.m. to a 10 p.m. kickoff at the latest, 9 something at the latest. So it's actually been quite good watching. I've watched most of it. I think it's just been an impressive evolution of the women's game. I think you're seeing professionalism creep in. You're seeing teams with the most time they've ever had together as a squad. You're just seeing the resources, the analysis, the detail in the game evolving. And you're probably seeing the biggest mobilization of fan support and following that a tournament like this has ever had.
Yeah, and I think from this side of the pond, there's so much excitement for obviously the knockout stages, but when it comes to women's Rugby World Cup, what's going to happen in the 2025 edition? Because that's happening in England, and the much vaunted, the big hope, and it's great for the women's game to have such a target. You know, I think like any business, any sport, you've played in championship winning sides, that when you go, right, a coach gets you in a room and go, in 12 months time, we're lifting that trophy, in 24 months, in whatever it might be, gives you real focus. So the focus for women's rugby on this side of the pond is sell out Twickenham, 82,000. at the 2025 Rugby World Cup. Obviously, a lot to go first. Huge business to take care of in New Zealand over the coming weeks. But yeah, I think if this one doesn't really smash into the public consciousness like, say, the Lionesses did, I think the hope would be that 2025 will be rugby union's moment when it comes to the women's game.
Absolutely. And I think that's really what gets a lot of people excited. And you know, Ilona Maher was on this pod and she was saying she would love England to win this World Cup just to create the buzz and the drive towards 2025 in England, rewarding the professionalism that they've done as well. And I thought that was quite a great point. But before 2025, do you think it's feasible that this Red Roses side starts having standalone games at Twickenham where they get maybe not 80,000, but hopefully, but big enough crowds that financially it's a revenue generator for them in the game and allows them to sort of evolve in that sort of financial business model where previously they've been a bit more, you know, a lot of their funding comes from the pies of the men generate at Twickenham.
Mate, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And what we're seeing, to use the Lionesses and the England women's football team as a comparison, we're seeing them get big old crowds at Wembley. You know, we're getting them selling out grounds across the UK, which in turn brings revenue, brings a business model that can then reward the players appropriately when it comes to payments and salary and sponsorship and everything. It's kind of a running conversation about women's sport in general. And obviously there are some women's sport that have paid their way for ages, whether that's athletics or tennis, golf, one or two other examples. But the ones that have probably been in the slipstream of the men's version of that sport, be it football or soccer, rugby union, maybe cricket, but to a lesser extent, because we've seen with the 100 competition over here, a lot of the women's cricket matches have been commanding big crowds and big revenues on their own without the need of the men. So yeah, it's a big picture piece, and that's what the England, I know the RFU, and I think that's when you speak to people who are high up in the governance of the women's game, it's about just taking their own steps and forging their own path. In the past, you would have played in a game at Twickenham and then the women would have been on after. A lot of the crowd would have dispersed. It's later on into the evening. And there, you know, a handful of people, a few thousand rattling around in an 82,000. Then the move has been in the last few years, actually, there's no point doing that. Let's go to Kingsholm, Welford Road, Doncaster, Exeter, Sandy Park, yeah, Northampton, Sandy Franklin's Park. Gardens. Yeah, whatever it might be, heartlands of the game, and sell it out on their own back. And that's what we saw in the 2021 autumn when the Red Roses put the Black Ferns twice to the sword. Big old crowd at Sandy Park, big old crowd at Franklin's Gardens. And that, for me, is a better model than getting 10, 15,000 or the same crowd in at Twickenham. Because Twickenham costs a lot of money to fire up, a lot of money to staff. You'd be much better off having 15,000 tearing down the place of Franklin's Gardens than you would 15,000 rattling around at Twickenham. So with all aspects of the women's game, whether it's the way it's played, the governance, the administration, it's just doing it its own way, learning from the mistakes of the men's game and making sure they don't repeat them. And when I watch the women's game, I always think they've got an opportunity to do things the men's game aren't doing anymore. A real focus on speed, skill, aerobic, pace. Don't make it about gain line, ruck speed, going through the phases, war of attrition on the gain line. We see enough of that in the men's game. So whenever you watch the women's game, you don't want them to be playing a version of sevens, but you want them to make sure that their version of the game is unique, it stands alone, and it gets fans in because they want to watch women's rugby because it's a version of the sport that they really enjoy watching. I don't want to make a version of the sport that just imitates the men. I think that's a point you get from speaking to someone like Giselle Mather, who's one of the top coaches in the women's game. Let's do it our own way. And if I think the women's game does that, it's going to be flying over the next few years leading up to 2025.
Completely agree. And I think now's time to sort of turn and look towards those quarterfinal matchups and just get your thoughts on what you've made of some of them. I think, you know, you start with France taking on Italy. Italy coming second in their group over the USA, and their reward was a quarterfinal against France. I quite like this game, though. It's a repeat of a Six Nations match, but also Italy beating France in the lead up to the World Cup as well, gives it a bit more spice. Italy have joined the professional ranks this year as well, and you've seen an uptick in some of their performances. Lost to Canada, but a strong performance against the US and beating Japan as well.
First ever Italy side to make a Rugby World Cup knockout. It's massive, massive achievement. Something the men haven't been able to do ever since 87. And I like the look of the game. And I think a lot of us do want to see France, New Zealand in the semi-final with potentially or probably the Red Roses lying in wait. Although I think England might be in the earlier semi-final and maybe New Zealand will be in the later one if they get there for TV purposes over in New Zealand. But Italy can beat France. There's absolutely no two ways about it. This French side are very frustrating to watch. They're kind of like the men of a few years ago. We know how good they are. We know the quality they've got. But they're against England. They're dropping loads of balls. They're making mistakes. And you're actually thinking, you know, as athletes, at skill level, at you've potentially got England. Not better. You're not better than England. But you can certainly cause England some problems. And then they would... you get done under the high ball or knock on with the, you know, with an opportunity to make a line break. So this France team are fallible. They're very, very good, but they're also fallible. I'd probably back them, but we saw when England won the World Cup in 2014, they managed to avoid the Black Ferns because Ireland picked them off and they ended up playing against Ireland and Canada. So things happen in World Cup knockouts, and you'd be a brave man, either of us, to say that all those quarterfinals are going to go to form with France, New Zealand, England, and probably Canada reaching the semi-finals. There could be a shock along the way somewhere there. What do you reckon?
No, I agree. I think Italy have an underdog status there for sure. I do think France should win. I think the way France, even on a bad day, with some of their attacking rugby, defended England in that game was very impressive. The tackle count, the confrontational of nullifying England's game line, because England do play a little bit of bully ball at times in the 22. They're very strong over the game line. It opens up all their game and time on the ball. And I thought France did a great job of snuffing that out a little bit. So for me, I think it's a France win more likely. But I completely think that, you know, Italy are a little bit of a dark horse. Didn't have their best game against Japan or Canada, I would say. They probably peaked in the US game, but definitely capable of getting through that quarterfinal. If we look at the next quarterfinal on the list, you've got New Zealand and Wales. These two teams have already met in the tournament. This one, to me, seems probably one of the more formalities of the quarterfinals. You know, I'd hope Wales find a way to rally, but I just think New Zealand's attacking output in that game was levels above. Where Wales have a chance is in the forwards. When it came to set piece, they looked very strong, got lots of reward. And that's where they're going to have to drag New Zealand into their game and try and make it an arm wrestle type of game where set piece can be a difference maker.
Yeah, I can't see Wales, unfortunately, getting close here. I'd love to be proved wrong. But, when you watch, I was at King's Home for the Wales England-Wales game at the start of the year, February, March kind of time, I think it was March. And, you know, there's some individual quality in Wales. We know all about it. But they're still way off. I think they are, you know, they've got their professional contracts in. They're moving in a positive direction with the women's game. But I think they're years and years behind the likes of England and New Zealand and France. So, I think that's a New Zealand procession. Likewise for England. And then the North America clash. I mean, you're our North American expert. I mean, this is going to be cool, this one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you've got to favour Canada. They deserve it. I think they were convincing winners against the US last week. We had Rob Kane earlier on in the show. And, you know, I don't think it's all doom and gloom for the US. This one has potential upset on it. I think there's a lot at stake. Rivalry, North American rivalry. And I think the US showed they can be competitive against Canada. The key for me is them holding onto the ball and playing in the right areas of the field. The first half, possession and territory so far against them. They did valiant efforts to sort of keep Canada out as much as they did, but they'll lose the game if they allow that to happen again. In that second half, they turned it round. They scored. They showed they could be competitive. They had an unlucky disallowed try, which was quite a big swing moment in the game for them. And then they crumbled a little bit at the end, giving away that last try. But for me, This one ain't predetermined. I think this one comes down to the day and who plays better rugby. And, you know, I think Canada on a 6-game winning streak against the United States, which isn't ever a great stat, but it was only 2019 the last time the US beat them. And I think It's always interesting when you play a team and then you play them again the next week. And now this time it's knockout rugby. You just never know. Pressure's on, different game. I think that one is probably Canada's game, but could go either way.
And tell me if you can, before we, I think we've got, you know, before we chat, Prem and a few domestic issues over here. So tell me how the women's game in the States is growing, because we know, say, if you look at the women's soccer team, they're an absolutely huge commercial entity, aren't they? And they are comparable to the men in all kinds of different ways in soccer. Are we at that point with the rugby union team, or is there still a bit of a sort of commercial gap between the men and the women stateside?
Still a commercial gap, but when you look at America and where women's rugby is, the participation levels, and really the university track that women's rugby has due to Title IX, which is a, you know, put into law, I think about, it was 50 years ago this year in the United States, equal sports scholarships for men and women. That's making a lot more women's programs going varsity, making it D1, making it scholarship territory. That is slowly going to pave the way for similar how women's soccer is such a big collegiate sport and a factory for producing these world-class players. That's only going to keep growing in the women's game, especially with a World Cup in America on the horizon for them as well. I do think they are a game changer here. And I do think the American women's side have a shorter path to being top tier one team than the men's do. And I think that as well will galvanize the country around them from a national base, because as soon as a men's or women's USA team get competitive on the world stage to where they're one to four in the world consistently, it's going to change the game over here, because Americans love to root for their country, love to chant USA, USA. And I think that will be a real difference maker. I just think commercially, rugby in America still has a massive gap, men and women's, to everywhere else. And I think there's still a lot of growth that needs to be done there. But I think the women's game, if anything, is the shortest climb of all the growth that needs to happen.
And less competition, I imagine. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Would you say there's more competition amongst men's sports with the NFL and other? I know there's women's versions of the NBA, of course, and lots of others. But do you think there is more of an opportunity to attract more people on the women's side of things?
Completely. I think one of the things rugby has is there's not many full contact women's sports out there. Even if you look over there, there's no real football equivalent. Wrestling's starting to get a little bit bigger, with women's wrestling growing a little bit more into collegiate programs. But really, you know, lacrosse is the only sport. But the thing with lacrosse is the men and women play two different games. It's a different form of contact, different form of type of game. With rugby, it's equal contact, equal men and women's. And I think that's really, with, you know, a lot of the equality movement and everything, it's a strength for rugby in America. And the fact that these women can play a full contact sport, I think it changes the game. And I think it just makes it more and more attractive, because soccer's a big sport here. But after that, if you want to be a bit more physical or a bit more, you know, you've got basketball, WNBA, but there's no other contact sport that it really competes with. And I do think it has an opportunity to grow a niche in the market. I think the thing rugby in America, men or women's, has to be smart about is picking their windows and seasons and what sports they compete with, because there is a big pie of fans in America, but the big three have so much of the pie that you need to be clever and pick your moments of when you're really trying to galvanize exposure, you know, fan base, revenue, ticket sales, all of this to change the game. Because it is a tier two or tier three sport at the moment. There's no denying that when you compare it to the big ones at the top.
Yeah, and just finally on this, mate, you it's sort of the USP of American sports. And so many people on this side of the pond look enviously over at American sports. We're seeing all this crisis at Premiership rugby level, finances. Everyone goes, well, look what the NFL do. Look what they do in NBA. Look what they do in MLB or whatever. But one of the advantages American sports has is the way it's governed, the way they have no competition with international sport. Do they? There's no international NFL calendar to take players out and pull them here and there. And they all have their periods in the calendar. And then the danger or the challenge for rugby union is how to fit into a sporting landscape that's really well set and really imprinted on the nation's consciousness.
I agree, mate. It has to be clever. Even the Rugby World Cup coming here, the men or women's, would be smarter to do it outside of football season, you know, and change the window of where you do the World Cup to adapt to that, because that's just a reality of where the sport is, if that makes sense. And so the difference I see from, especially when you look at rugby and the way it's professionalized in the UK and some of the problems it's had, it kind of inherited from amateur to professional and kind of tried to figure out a commercial, a revenue model, and a way to make money and to make sense on the fly, where I do think American sports were built in professional with commercial revenue, business model and plans already built in. And that's why there's a little bit of difference in some of the sustainability and the successfulness of some of those models.
Mm. And just remind me of the NFL season, when it runs.
NFL season runs from like September to February.
Yeah, so that's going to, yeah. I wonder if the World Cup, World Cups, for as long as I can remember, have run in September and October. So
yeah, but look at the soccer in Qatar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. It can be done.
I should say, but I've been Americanized.
Yeah. No, you have.
They have enough time to figure that out. The summer, you've just got baseball. You don't have any basketball. You don't have hockey. You just got baseball.
Would conditions hold up? Not too hot in California in August?
California would be okay. It'd be more some of the other states. Like, you couldn't do Florida, couldn't do Texas very often. But you still could pull it off. The East Coast, you could definitely pull it off. It would be hotter, but it wouldn't be out of control heat where you couldn't play. It would just be a warmer World Cup. I would say, to me, doing that or doing it in the spring, but obviously you don't want to interrupt the Six Nations. That's big money. But I think those World Cups won't be in their traditional windows. Just as a spectator from the outside, if they're really trying to put a commercial model together, they'd be silly to go head-to-head with American football and think that would be a successful plan.
I know it's a long way off, 2031. Lot can change in the next hour at the moment, let alone in the next 8 years, or 9 years. I can't see a situation where they play that out of the traditional slot, because Qatar, they can, you know, there's so much money swilling around when it comes to the FIFA World Cup that they can probably pay in the Premier League. They're probably compensating all these clubs for losing players half through the season. I'm sure there have been all these deals that have gone on. Would World Rugby do that just to get more eyeballs on it in the States? I mean, that's half the point of taking it.
The thing is with the States is the money factor. And I do think take the game there, but also the potential commercial upside is the biggest. It has the potential to be the biggest revenue generating Rugby World Cup ever. Like, that's really what the United States brings. Like, if it's done right, you get fans from outside of the world and inside of the world galvanized there with blue chip American sponsors and with the real big players of American sport and the stadium operators and everything behind it. You have a chance to elevate the game in the United States, but also in the world, to a level that it's not seen commercially. Like, there's no rugby country that can financially compare to the market of the United States. Like, the UK and the RFU, they generate a lot of money, but it's still a fraction. California has more people, has a bigger or bigger economy than the whole of the UK. That's just California. You can't compete those two. You know what I mean? That's what the upside is, but if we're going to do this and we're going to have this time to build it, I think it has to be built right.
That's so interesting. I really hadn't thought of that, and it's a long way off, but that is going to be very, very interesting whether the powers that be are able to do something like that to maximize the World Cup.
I think they'll find a way, because I think rugby's going to have to adapt its model sooner than later anyway. And I feel like this will be part of the reshuffling in the long term, from when 2025 or whenever all these windows and deals are tied up. I think we're going to have to see long term a completely different sort of schedule for the commercial viability of the game to continue in a better form. But let's wrap that up now. That's the Rugby World Cup chat. And then
to be continued. Yeah.
And we'll transition to the Premiership.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
All right, Chris, it's Premiership Rugby time, and there's been a lot going on in Premiership Rugby over this last month or so. You know, we've had Alex Lowe a few times to update us on WAS and Worcester, but I'd love to get your thoughts of what's been going on and your thoughts of the picture at the moment.
Yeah, I was listening to your pods with Alex. He's like the Grim Reaper, isn't he? Getting him on to pick through the latest terrible news. I mean, I've just come back from some extended parental leave, so I've kind of been following it from afar. And you kind of look at Worcester and Wasps in isolation. Worcester had been rumbling for a while. I think Worcester, ever since, you know, Cecil Duckworth, a number of different ownership models that hadn't really worked, always looking for investment. And the writing was on the wall around about August time that things were going to get really, really nasty at Worcester. And so they proved. WAS, for me, I feel really kind of deflated by the WAS situation, because that there were times going to the Ricoh Arena, as it was, which were awesome. You know, people will forget that, and they will talk about the Coventry move being failed. And ultimately, they borrowed money to pay for it. They couldn't pay it back. And that's business and that's life. And they've fallen by the wayside. They've fallen on their sword. But at times, that Coventry experience was absolutely outstanding. When the Ricoh was near full, I remember going to Premiership semi-finals there with last-minute tries. Charles Pietau scoring at the death and Gopeth kicking a brilliant goal to take them into a Euro quarter or Euro semi, I think it was. There were some great times there. Obviously, it was being financially, if mismanaged is probably too harsh. They took a gamble raising that bond scheme that didn't work. And then COVID absolutely obliterated them, didn't it? And that's a model that clubs should be looking at, how to make money outside their rugby operations, how to make money from a hotel, how to make money from a casino, from a conference centre. That's what clubs need to do. If the money's not adding up from just the rugby side of things, how can they make their assets, their land, work for them? So I feel really deflated about Worcester, but deflated about WAS, because it was a gamble, Coventry, and I know it was controversial and it's not worked out in the long run, but it could have worked out. Having said that, if they were borrowing 35 or raising 35 million quid and they couldn't pay it back, you know, that writing's been on the wall for a while. They were defaulting on payments, you know.
And obviously with just the change in interest rates, the financial changes in this last year alone make it a completely different market to refinance than it was, say, this time last year.
Yeah, and you can simultaneously, can't you, feel devastated for the 167 people who lost their jobs and all those at Worcester. But also, and then this is tough because I know that the people at Premiership Rugby are grappling with this. You can't necessarily have clubs that aren't paying their debts, aren't paying their tax. To what extent should the other clubs or the league or the RFU bail them out? Now, there's an argument that COVID has hurt WAS. There's an argument that these owners have hurt Worcester. But the model being as it is, I do sympathise with the powers that be that weren't able to bail these clubs out, because that's not fair then to the ones who have been paying their taxes and have been making it work financially. But no, I'm gutted to have seen both of those clubs go the way they've gone, and it'd be amazing if they came back. But in what form, how, that is anyone's guess. Even if they go down to the Championship, can they pay their creditors? Can they raise a squad? Can they work their way back? Where will Wasps be playing if the you know they don't own the arena? Where will it's far from the case that they'll drop to the champ, have a season or two, come back up. You know, do they amalgamate with their amateur arms, which is what London Welsh did after their liquidation? Loads of questions, and yeah, you just really feel for the supporters because they've had their pride and joy ripped away from them, and you know that's horrible when you think how all of us rely on sport for our entertainment and some solace.
No, yeah, my heart breaks for the players, the staff, the fans, because you know the commitment and the drive. It wasn't anything from their doing. It wasn't really an on-field performance issue at all. To me, it's a massive wake-up call for the procedures of oversight and the way PRL and the RFU can actually oversight and have transparency and be able to sort of, you know, have a recourse to try and address these issues before they become an issue. At the moment, that's not really the model or the way the PRL works. My next question to you is, there's been a lot reported about sort of, you know, new ideas for the Premiership, 10-team Premiership, a Tier 2 Premiership alongside that. Have you heard anything about that, or what are your thoughts on that?
You know, without trying to sound wise after the event, or you know, a bit of a after timer, I tweeted in 2018 that the Premiership needs to contract rather than expand, and it has to do that in alignment with a second tier. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, and I can understand the thinking that the Championship wasn't really working, the RFU didn't want to throw good money after bad, so the call was taken to expand to 40 or expand to 13, then ideally to 14, and then really have the Championship cast adrift for the rest of the community game as a semi-pro or amateur entity. In reality, we don't have enough high-quality clubs for 14 in the top flight. But equally, if we went to 10, we've got 4, 5, 6 clubs who are ambitious and want to, you know, be a professional entity that have reasonable crowds. You know, so if we go down to 10, we can't just say, oh, well, you know, Worcester and Wasps have gone, but then one other goes, and then they're cast aside. They need to be part of a second tier that perhaps is run by the Premiership, that perhaps does get a slice of the broadcast pie, that perhaps does get the opportunity, you know, to run alongside or just under the Premiership as a kind of Premiership 1 and 2. So I'm in favour of that model. I haven't done the numbers, and that's for, you know, the administrators far more experience of that thing than you or I. But I think that has been the way it should have been going for the last 5 years or so, once it was clear that player welfare, overlap with internationals, overlap with Europe, made any kind of expansion just nonsensical. So let's work out. Let's not look at France. Let's look at France for some good things France do, and they do loads of good things. But equally, France has a culture in rugby that we don't have in England. We've got little pockets of strongholds, but we don't have a whole part of the country like the south of France, where I was in the Dordogne recently. Places like Brive, Bordeaux, Bayonne, these are rugby heartlands. Everywhere you walk around, there's rugby posts rather than football nets. So you just got to make sure that what England do really suits them. It's a problem Wales have got at the moment. Are they doing what suits them? No. Are Ireland doing what suits them? Yes. Are France doing what suits them? Yes. But not every country in the world is doing something that really suits their rugby culture, their rugby infrastructure. So I think England and the administrators sit down and go, right, how many clubs do we have? How many areas do we have? How many strongholds do we have? What model works for us? And whether that's a league of 10 and then 8 or 8 and 8. I would hate to go to conferences because I think it's all about a league system. But a 10-team Prem and then a strong second tier that is part of a promotion relegation piece. That for me is the answer. Although I get that it's probably easier said than done.
And then do you know the latest on the P-share status of Worcester and Wasps at the moment?
I don't know definitely what's going to happen, but I'd be very surprised if either kept their P share. Just from what you're hearing out of Premiership Rugby. And the reason would be, and Rob Baxter got some stick for these comments, but the point Rob made was, well, if every club is able to go into administration, have their debts cleared, and then still get a slice of the commercial revenue, the broadcast revenue, what will stop other clubs kind of almost going into voluntary administration, getting some of their creditors, their debt settled, but keeping the P share? Premiership Rugby also argued that when you go down to the Championship, the P share is not worth it's worth a very small fraction of what it is worth when you're a Premiership side. But I don't think that those clubs will keep their P share for right or wrong.
And then my next question is around CVC and, you know, their involvement going forward, how it works. They obviously had a big injection of cash, which seems to be all spent by the clubs. And my understanding of the CVC investment is that CVC don't own anything of any of the clubs individually. They bought a percentage of that P share revenue for the rest of time or whatever. And so yeah. My question to you is, do you think that was a good investment now when you see clubs failing, you see issues going on, the money's spent, and now 20-something percent of the total P share goes to CVC, and that's really where they'll do well off this investment, but the individual clubs themselves are fracturing?
Yeah, and as it looks at the moment, it looks like a disastrous situation. The clubs are in desperate need of money, yet they're giving away 27% of all their revenues. So the money they were given, the 14 million quid or whatever it was, seems to just been absorbed into debt. However, yeah. Would some more of these clubs have gone bust without that CVC money, which kind of happened just before COVID? So maybe that's kept the wolf from the door, and we could have lost more than two. We could have lost five. And maybe a combination of CVC money and government loans have meant that more clubs have stayed afloat. I just think it's a real shame, because the whole plan was for clubs to use that CVC money to invest in their infrastructure to, you know, I mean, I say build a hotel as if it's an easy thing to do. I mean, these things cost probably 100 million quid to build, or whatever, 50 million quid. I don't know how building a hotel, I think it's spoken about quite flippantly. But that was the plan, wasn't it? Here's some money. Use it to build your commercial, your revenue, the potential to make more revenues. And CVC said, look, we'll take 27%, but the pot will be so much bigger that 27% you won't mind, because you're still getting more in. So where it goes now is it looks pretty bleak, because we're not seeing any evidence of revenues going up. And I'm sure that CVC are doing stuff behind the scenes, because that's how they operate. And, you know, speaking to people who are involved in CVC, they talk very highly about what these people can do for the sport. So I wouldn't want to write them off at all. It just, as it stands, we're not seeing anything, are we? And I think that's where some fans are going, well, what was that all about? But I suppose, without using COVID as a cop-out, you do have to see it in the context of these clubs losing so much money in the last few years, and how is CVC able to build from that kind of base? So I think COVID has just came at such a bad time that any of the plans and the hopes and dreams for the clubs around the CVC investment haven't been able to materialise the way they would like.
No, great answer, mate. And probably my last question on Prem Rugby is, have you heard any rumblings of other clubs that could potentially be in trouble? Do you think Wasps and Worcester are the last two that we'll see in this sort of situation this season? Or are there any rumblings that potentially more are in bad ways?
Well, I think there are other clubs that are struggling and aren't paying up to the cap. And, you know, the London Irish owner, Mick Crossan, has come out loads of times and said, look, I'd sell the club for peanuts. It's costing me so much money. And you do have clubs in the league that I kind of think there's a split. You get clubs that are knocking around with 5,000 fans. You know, your club, you know, 5 to 10 clubs like Newcastle, London Irish, Worcester, as they were. And then you've got the clubs that are, you know, always up at 15,000, 12,000, 13,000, 15,000. Bristol crowds are growing. Leicester's always going to have a big crowd. Gloucester, Northampton, Bath, very competitive crowds. Harlequins, a competitive crowd.
Exeter.
So Exeter, exactly. Their numbers have dipped, actually, but, you know, hopefully they can stabilise. It's just a weird time, isn't it? And all this is going on. Well, the rugby on the pitch is great. And even a club like Newcastle, who, you know, are often considered, you know, how do I say this, one of the poorer relations of the league, and I mean that with all the respects in the world, but when you look at their, you know, their squad, it's on a shoestring budget compared to others. I don't think they spend up to the cap. Their crowds aren't big. They're often knocking down the bottom end of the league, but they've had some great performances and some great wins this season, and they deserve a load of respect for that. So I don't see any club, I don't think another club will go, but, you know, I don't think we can say that with a huge amount of certainty. It was always the case that Worcester for the last 6 months there were problems there, and Wasps, that kind of bond issue was just in its, you know, we probably should have been more across it as journalists at the time, but when you're thinking in hindsight, yeah, this was being flagged quite a bit about the bond issue and about the money they were losing hand over fist. So to answer your question, I think there are other clubs that aren't in a great place, but I would hope that we won't lose another one this season. But, you know, such is the world we're living in. You can't say much for sure.
I'd second that. And then we don't have to bring the Grim Reaper, Alex Lowe, back on.
Well, he'll probably jump onto our call now and say that two more clubs have gone. We shouldn't laugh about it. But yeah, I feel a bit bad for my colleague, Sarah, because she's been working like her fingers to the bone the last 6 weeks, doing all the finance stuff, all the doom and gloom stories. And then just when I come back, we're thinking, oh, internationals are coming up, knockouts of the women's.
Yeah.
You know, there's some big Prem games. So Europe's around the corner. So maybe we can start to focus and enjoy the rugby going forward, at least for the next few weeks.
Well, let's hope so, mate. Thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it, Chris. And wishing you all the best.
Good to see you, Alex, and look forward to you coming over and catching up in person.
Well, that's a wrap on this week's show. So good to have Chris Jones on and Rob Kane. Lots of talk with them this week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. A reminder to keep liking, sharing, favoriting, retweeting, telling your friends about the pod. We keep wanting to grow this. We're not going anywhere. We're here weekly all season long. And for those of you that did have issues with the Geo Block, that has now been fixed on YouTube. So if you went to audio because you couldn't watch it, get back on the video on NBC Sports YouTube page. We're back up without any restrictions. But for now, for Alex Corbacero, from all of us at NBC Sports, thanks for listening and watching, and we'll see you again next week.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.